across the red carpet, waving at the photographers and ignoring the handful of reporters, one of whom had the audacity to yell, "Hey, Carl, any comment on the verdict in Mississippi?" Carl, of course, did not hear, or pretended not to. But his pace quickened slightly, and they were soon inside, on somewhat safer turf. He hoped. They were greeted by paid greeters. Coats were taken, smiles were offered, friendly cameras appeared, old pals materialized, and they were soon lost in the warm cluster of seriously rich people pretending to enjoy one another's company. Brianna found her soulmate, another anorexic trophy with the same unusual body, everything superbly starved but the ridiculous breasts. Carl went straight for the bar and almost made it before he was practically tackled by the one jerk he had hoped to avoid.
"Carl, old boy, bad news down south, I hear,"
the man boomed as loudly as possible.
"Yes, very bad," Carl said in a much lower voice as he grabbed a champagne flute and began to drain it.
Pete Flint was number 228 on the Forbes list of the 400 richest Americans. Carl was number 310, and each man knew exactly where the other fit on the roster. Numbers 87 and 141 were also in the crowd, along with a host of unranked contenders.
"Thought you boys had things under control,"
Flint pressed on, slurping a tall glass full of either scotch or bourbon. He somehow managed to frown while working hard to conceal his delight.
"Yes, we thought so too," Carl said, wishing he could slap the fat jowls 12 inches away.
"What about the appeal?"
Flint asked gravely.
"We're in great shape."
At last year's auction, Flint had valiantly hung on to the frenzied end and walked away with the brain after gunshot, a $6 million artistic waste, but one that launched the MUAB's current capital campaign. No doubt he would be in the hunt for tonight's grand prize.
"Good thing we shorted Crane last week," he said.
Carl started to curse him, but kept his cool. Flint ran a hedge fund famous for its daring. Had he really shorted Crane Chemical in anticipation of a bad verdict? Carl's puzzled glare concealed nothing.
"Oh, yes,"
Flint went on, pulling on his glass and smacking his lips.
"Our man down there said you were screwed."
"We'll never pay a dime," Carl said gamely.
"You'll pay in the morning, old boy. We're betting Crane stock drops 20%.
And with that, he turned and walked away, leaving Carl to finish off his drink and lunge for another.
20%?
Carl's laser-quick mind did the math. He owned 45% of the outstanding common shares of Crane Chemical, a company with a market value of $3.2 billion, based on the day's closing price. A 20% decline would cost him $280 million on paper. No real cash losses, of course, but still a rough day around the office. 10% was more like it, he thought. The boys in finance agreed with him. Could Flint's hedge fund short a significant chunk of Crane's stock without Carl knowing about it? He stared at a confused bartender and pondered the question. Yes, it was possible, but not likely. Flint was simply rubbing in a little salt. The museum's director appeared from nowhere, and Carl was delighted to see him. He would never mention the verdict, if he in fact knew about it. He would say only nice things to Carl, and of course he would comment on how fabulous Brianna looked. He would ask about Sadler and inquire into the renovation of their home in the Hamptons. They chatted about such things as they carried their drinks through the crowded lobby, dodging little pockets of dangerous conversations, and settled themselves before abused Imelda.
"Magnificent, isn't she?" the director mused.
"Beautiful," Carl said, glancing to his left as number 141 happened by. "What will it go for?"
"We've been debating that all day around here. Who knows with this crowd? I'd say at least 5 million.
"And what's it worth?"
The director smiled as a photographer snapped their picture.
"Now that's an entirely different issue, isn't it? The sculptor's last major work was sold to a Japanese gentleman for around 2 million. Of course, the Japanese gentleman was not donating large sums of money to our little museum."
Carl took another sip and acknowledged the game.
Muab's campaign goal was $100 million over 5 years. According to Brianna, they were about halfway there and needed a big boost from the evening's auction. An art critic with the Times introduced himself and joined their conversation. Wonder if he knows about the verdict, Carl thought. The critic and the director discussed the Argentine sculptor and his mental problems as Carl studied Imelda and asked himself if he really wanted it permanently situated in the foyer of his luxurious penthouse. His wife certainly did. Chapter 3. The Paytons' temporary home was a 3-bedroom apartment on the second level of an old complex near the university. Wes had lived nearby in his college days and still found it hard to believe he was back in the neighborhood. But there had been so many drastic changes, it was difficult to dwell on just one. How temporary? That was the great question between husband and wife, though the issue hadn't been discussed in weeks, nor would it be discussed now. Maybe in a day or two, when the fatigue and the shock wore off, and they could steal a quiet moment and talk about the future. Wes eased the car through the parking lot, passing an overfilled dumpster with debris littered around it, mainly beer cans and broken bottles. The college boys humored themselves by hurling their empties from the upper floors across the lot above the cars in the general direction of the dumpster. When the bottles crashed, the noise boomed through the complex, and the students were amused. Others were not. For the two sleep-deprived Paytons, the racket was at times unbearable. The owner, an old client, was widely considered the worst slumlord in town, by the students anyway. He offered the place to the Paytons, and their handshake deal called for $1,000 a month in rent. They had lived there for 7 months, paid for 3, and the landlord insisted he was not worried. He was patiently waiting in line with many other creditors. The law firm of Payton & Payton had once proven it could attract clients and generate fees, and its two partners were certainly capable of a dramatic comeback. Try this comeback, Wes thought, as he turned into a parking place. Is a verdict of $41 million drama enough? For a moment, he felt feisty. Then he was tired again. Slaves to a dreadful habit, both got out of the car and grabbed their briefcases in the rear seat. No, Mary Grace announced suddenly. We are not working tonight. Leave these in the car. Yes, ma'am. They hustled up the stairs, loud, raunchy rap spilling from a window nearby. Mary Grace rattled the keys and unlocked the door, and suddenly they were inside, where both children were watching television with Ramona, their Honduran nanny. Liza, the 9-year-old, rushed forth yelling, Mommy, we won! We won! Mary Grace lifted her in the air and clutched her tightly. Yes, dear, we won. 40 billion! Millions, dear, not billions. Mac, the 5-year-old, ran to his father, who yanked him up, and for a long moment they stood in the narrow foyer and squeezed their children. For the first time since the verdict, Wes saw tears in his wife's eyes.
We saw you on TV, Mac was saying. You look tired,
Liza said. I am tired, Wes said. Ramona watched from a distance, a tight smile barely visible. She wasn't sure what the verdict meant, but she understood enough to be pleased with the news. Overcoats and shoes were removed, and the little Payton family fell onto the sofa, a very nice thick leather one, where they hugged and tickled and talked about school. Wes and Mary Grace had managed to keep most of their furnishings, and the shabby apartment was decorated with fine things that not only reminded them of the past, but more important, reminded them of the future. This was just a stop, an unexpected layover. The den floor was covered with notebooks and papers, clear evidence that the homework had been done before the television was turned on.
I'm starving,
Mac announced as he tried in vain to undo his father's tie. Mom says we're having macaroni and cheese, Wes said.
All right!
Both kids voiced their approval, and Ramona eased into the kitchen.
Does this mean we get a new house?
Liza asked. I thought you liked this place, Wes said.
I do, but we're still looking for a new house, right?
Of course we are. They had been careful with the children. They had explained the basics of the lawsuit to Liza. A bad company polluted water that harmed many people. And she quickly declared that she didn't like the company either. And if the family had to move into an apartment to fight the company, then she was all for it. But leaving their fine new home had been traumatic. Liza's last bedroom was pink and white and had everything a little girl could want. Now she shared a smaller room with her brother, and though she didn't complain, she was curious about how long the arrangement might last. Mac was generally too preoccupied with full-day kindergarten to worry about living quarters. Both kids missed the old neighborhood, where the homes were large and the backyards had pools and gym sets. Friends were next door or just around the corner. The school was private and secure. Church was a block away, and they knew everyone there. Now they attended a city elementary school, where there were far more black faces than white, and they worshipped in a downtown Episcopal church that welcomed everyone. "We won't move anytime soon," Mary Grace said, "but maybe we can start looking."
"I'm starving," Max said again.
The topic of housing was routinely avoided when one of the kids raised it, and Mary Grace finally rose to her feet.
"Let's go cook," she said to Liza.
Wes found the remote and said to Mac, "Let's watch Sports Center."
Anything but local news.
"Sure."
Ramona was boiling water and dicing a tomato. Mary Grace hugged her quickly and said, "A good day?" "Yes, a good day," she agreed. No problems at school. Homework was already finished. Liza drifted off to her bedroom. She had yet to show any interest in kitchen matters.
"A good day for you?" Ramona asked.
"Yes, very good. Let's use the white cheddar."
She found a block of it in the fridge and began grating it.
"You can relax now?" Ramona asked.
"Yes, for a few days anyway."
Through a friend at church, they had found Ramona hiding and half-starved in a shelter in Baton Rouge, sleeping on a cot and eating boxed food sent south for hurricane victims. She had survived a harrowing 3-month journey from Central America through Mexico, then Texas, and on to Louisiana, where none of the things she had been promised materialized. No job, no host family, no paperwork, no one to take care of her. Under normal circumstances, hiring an illegal and unnaturalized nanny had never occurred to the Paytons. They quickly adopted her, taught her to drive but only on a few selected streets, taught her the basics of the cell phone, computer, and kitchen appliances, and pressed her to learn English. She had a good foundation from a Catholic school back home, and she spent her daytime hours holed up in the apartment cleaning and mimicking the voices on television. In 8 months, her progress was impressive. She preferred to listen, though, especially to Mary Grace, who needed someone to unload on. During the past 4 months, on the rare nights when Mary Grace prepared dinner, she chatted nonstop while Ramona absorbed every word. It was wonderful therapy, especially after a brutal day in a courtroom crowded with high-strung men.
"No trouble with the car?" Mary Grace asked.
The same question every night. Their second car was an old Honda Accord that Ramona had yet to damage. For many good reasons, they were terrified of turning loose on the streets of Hattiesburg an illegal, unlicensed, and quite uninsured alien in a Honda with a zillion miles and their two happy little children in the rear seat. They had trained Ramona to travel a memorized route through the back streets to the school, to the grocery, and if necessary, to their office. If the police stopped her, they planned to beg the cops, the prosecutor, and the judge. They knew them well. Wes knew for a fact that the presiding city judge had his own illegal pulling his weeds and cutting his grass.
"A good day," Ramona said. "No problem. Everything is fine."
A good day indeed, Mary Grace thought to herself as she began melting cheese. The phone rang and Wes reluctantly picked up the receiver. The number was unlisted because a crackpot had made threats. They used their cell phones for virtually everything. He listened, said something, hung up, and walked to the stove to disrupt the cooking.
"Who was it?"
Mary Grace asked with concern. Every call to the apartment was greeted with suspicion.
"Sherman at the office. Says there are some reporters hanging around looking for the stars."
Sherman was one of the paralegals.
Why is he at the office? Mary Grace asked.
Just can't get enough, I guess.
Do we have any olives for the salad?
No. What did you tell him?
I told him to shoot at one of them and the rest will disappear.
Toss the salad, please, she said to Ramona.
They huddled over a card table wedged in a corner of the kitchen, all five of them. They held hands as Wes prayed and gave thanks for the good things of life, for family and friends and school, and for the food. He was also thankful for a wise and generous jury and a fantastic result, but he would save that for later. The salad was passed first, then the macaroni and cheese.
Hey, Dad, can we camp out?
Mac blurted after he had swallowed. Of course, Wes said, his back suddenly aching. Camping out in the apartment meant layering the den floor with blankets and quilts and pillows and sleeping there, usually with the television on late at night, usually on Friday nights. It worked only if Mom and Dad joined the fun. Ramona was always invited, but wisely declined.
Same bedtime, though, Mary Grace said. This is a school night.
10 o'clock,
said Eliza, the negotiator.
9,
said Mary Grace, a 30-minute add-on that made both kids smile. Mary Grace was knee-to-knee with her children, savoring the moment and happy that the fatigue might soon be over. Maybe she could rest now and take them to school, visit their classes, and eat lunch with them. She longed to be a mother, nothing more, and it would be a gloomy day when she was forced to re-enter a courtroom. Wednesday night meant potluck casseroles at the Pine Grove Church, and the turnout was always impressive. The busy church was located in the middle of the neighborhood, and many worshipers simply walked a block or two on Sundays and Wednesdays. The doors were open 18 hours a day, and the pastor who lived in a parsonage behind the church was always there, waiting to minister to his people. They ate in the fellowship hall, an ugly metal addition stuck to the side of the chapel, where folding tables were covered with all manner of home-cooked recipes. There was a basket of white dinner rolls, a large dispenser of sweet tea, and of course, lots of bottled water. The crowd would be even larger tonight, and they hoped Jeanette would be there. A celebration was in order. Pine Grove Church was fiercely independent, with not the slightest link to any denomination, a source of quiet pride for its founder, Pastor Denny Ott. It had been built by Baptists decades earlier, then dried up like the rest of Beaumont. By the time Ott arrived, the congregation consisted of only a few badly scarred souls. Years of infighting had decimated its membership. Ott cleaned out the rest, opened the doors to the community, and reached out to the people. He had not been immediately accepted, primarily because he was from up north and spoke with such a clean, clipped accent. He had met a Beaumont girl at a Bible college in Nebraska, and she brought him south. Through a series of misadventures, he found himself as the interim pastor of Second Baptist Church. He wasn't really a Baptist, but with so few young preachers in the area, the church could not afford to be selective. 6 months later, all the Baptists were gone, and the church had a new name. He wore a beard and often preached in flannel shirts and hiking boots. Neckties were not forbidden, but were certainly frowned upon. It was the People's Church, a place where anyone could find peace and solace with no worries about wearing the Sunday best. Pastor Ott got rid of the King James and the old hymnal. He had little use for the mournful anthems written by ancient pilgrims. Worship services were loosened up, modernized with guitars and slideshows. He believed and taught that poverty and injustice were more important social issues than abortion and gay rights, but he was careful with his politics. The church grew and prospered, though he cared nothing about money. A friend from seminary ran a mission in Chicago, and through this connection, Ott maintained a large inventory of used but very usable clothing in the church's closet. He badgered the larger congregations in Hattiesburg and Jackson, and with their contributions kept a well-stocked food bank at one end of the fellowship hall. He pestered drug companies for their leftovers, and the church's pharmacy was filled with over-the-counter medications. Deniat considered all of Beaumont to be his mission, and no one would go hungry or homeless or sick if he could possibly prevent it. Not on his watch. And his watch never ended. He had conducted 16 funerals of his own people killed by Crane Chemical, a company he detested so bitterly that he constantly prayed for forgiveness. He didn't hate the nameless and faceless people who owned Crane. To do so would compromise his faith, but he most certainly hated the corporation itself. Was it a sin to hate a corporation? That furious debate raged in his soul every day, and to be on the safe side, he kept praying. All 16 were buried in the small cemetery behind the church. When the weather was warm, he cut the grass around the headstones, and when it was cold, he painted the white picket fence that surrounded the cemetery and kept the deer away. Though he had not planned it, his church had become the hub of anti-Crane activity in Cary County. Almost all of its members had been touched by the illness or death of someone harmed by the company. His wife's older sister finished Beaumont High with Mary Grace Shelby. Pastor Ott and the Paytons were extremely close. Legal advice was often dispensed in the pastor's study with the door closed and one of the Paytons on the phone. Dozens of depositions had been taken in the fellowship hall, packed with lawyers from big cities. Ott disliked the corporate lawyers almost as much as the corporation itself. Mary Grace had phoned Pastor Ott often during the trial and had always warned him not to be optimistic. He certainly was not. When she called 2 hours earlier with the astounding news, Ott grabbed his wife and they danced through the house, yelling and laughing. Crane had been nailed, humbled, exposed, brought to justice, finally. He was greeting his flock when he saw Jeanette enter with her stepsister Betty and the rest of her entourage. She was immediately engulfed by those who loved her, those who wanted to share in this great moment and offer a quiet word. They sat her in the rear of the room near an old piano, and a receiving line materialized. She managed to smile a few times and even say thanks, but she looked so weak and frail. With the casseroles growing colder by the minute, and with a full house, Pastor Ott finally called things to order and launched into a windy prayer of thanks. He finished with a flourish and said, "Let us eat." As always, the children and old folks lined up first, and dinner was served. Ott made his way to the back and was soon sitting next to Jeanette. As the attention shifted away from her and to the food, she whispered to her pastor,
"I'd like to go to the cemetery."
He led her through a side door onto a narrow gravel drive that dipped behind the church and ran for 50 yards to the small graveyard. They walked slowly, silently in the dark. Ott opened the wooden gate, and they stepped into the cemetery, neat and tidy, and well tended to. The headstones were small. These were working people. No monuments or crypts or gaudy tributes to great ones. Four rows down on the right, Jeanette knelt between two graves. One was Chad's, a sickly child who had lived only 6 years before tumors choked him. The other held the remains of Pete, her husband of 8 years. Father and son, resting side by side forever. She visited them at least once a week and never failed to wish she could join them. She rubbed both headstones at the same time, then began talking softly.
"Hello, boys. It's Mom. You won't believe what happened today."
Pastor Ott slipped away, leaving her alone with her tears and thoughts and quiet words that he did not want to hear. He waited by the gate, and as the minutes passed, he watched the shadows move through the rows of headstones as the moonlight shifted through the clouds. He had already buried Chad and Pete, 16 in all and counting. 16 silent victims who perhaps were not so silent anymore. From within the little picket-fenced cemetery at the Pine Grove Church, a voice had finally been heard. A loud, angry voice that begged to be heard and was demanding justice. He could see her shadow and hear her talking. He had prayed with Pete in the minutes before he finally slipped away, and he had kissed the forehead of little Chad in his final hour. he had scraped together money for their caskets and funerals. Then he and two of his deacons had dug the graves. Their burials were 8 months apart. She stood, said her farewells, and began moving. "We need to go inside," Ott said.
"Yes, thank you,"
she said, wiping her cheeks. Mr. Trudeau's table cost him $50,000, and since he wrote the check, he could damn well control who sat with him. To his left was Brianna, and next to her was her close friend Sandy, another skeleton who had just been contractually released from her last marriage and was on the prowl for husband number three. To his right was a retired banker friend and his wife, pleasant folks who preferred to chat about the arts. Carl's urologist sat directly across from him. He and his wife were invited because they said little. The odd man out was a lesser executive at Trudeau Group who simply drew the short straw and was there by coercion. The celebrity chef had whipped up a tasting menu that began with caviar and champagne, then moved on to a lobster bisque, a splash of sautéed foie gras with trimmings, fresh Scottish game hen for the carnivores, and a seaweed bouquet for the veggies. Dessert was a gorgeous layered gelato creation. Each round required a different wine, including dessert. Carl cleaned every plate put before him and drank heavily. He spoke only to the banker because the banker had heard the news from down south and appeared to be sympathetic. Brianna and Sandy whispered rudely and in the course of dinner hammered every other social climber in the crowd. They managed to push the food around their plates while eating virtually none of it. Carl, half drunk, almost said something to his wife while she tinkered with her seaweed. "Do you know how much that damn food cost?" he wanted to say, but there was no sense starting a fight. The celebrity chef, one Carl had never heard of, was introduced and got a standing ovation from the 400 guests, virtually all of them still hungry after five courses. But the evening wasn't about food. It was about money. Two quick speeches brought the auctioneer to the front. Abused Imelda was rolled into the atrium, hanging dramatically from a small mobile crane, and left to hover 20 feet off the floor for all to see clearly. Concert-style spotlights made her even more exotic. The crowd grew quiet as the tables were cleared by an army of illegal immigrants in black coats and ties. The auctioneer rambled on about Imelda, and the crowd listened. Then he talked about the artist, and the crowd really listened. Was he truly crazy, insane, close to suicide? They wanted details, but the auctioneer held the high ground. He was British and very proper, which would add at least $1 million to the winning bid. "I suggest we start the bidding at $5 million, he said through his nose, and the crowd gasped. Brianna was suddenly bored with Sandy. She moved closer to Carl, fluttered her eyelashes at him, and placed a hand on his thigh. Carl responded by nodding at the nearest floor assistant, a man he had already spoken to. The assistant flashed a sign to the podium, and Imelda came to life. "And we have $5 million, the auctioneer announced. Thunderous applause. "A nice place to start, thank you. And now onward to six." 6, 7, 8, 9, and Carl nodded at 10. He kept a smile on his face, but his stomach was churning. How much would this abomination cost him? There were at least 6 billionaires in the room, and several more in the making. No shortage of enormous egos, no shortage of cash, but at that moment, none of the others needed a headline as desperately as Carl Trudeau. And Pete Flint understood this. Two bidders dropped out on the way to $11 million. "How many are left?" Carl whispered to the banker who was watching the crowd and searching for the competition. "It's Pete Flint. Maybe one more." "That son of a bitch." When Carl nodded at 12, Brianna practically had her tongue in his ear. "We have $12 million. The crowd exploded with applause and hoorays, and the auctioneer wisely said, "Let's catch our breath here." Everyone took a sip of something. Carl gulped more wine. Pete Flint was behind him, two tables back, but Carl didn't dare turn around and acknowledge their little battle. If Flint had really shorted Crane's stock, then he would reap millions from the verdict. Carl obviously had just lost millions because of it. It was all on paper. But then wasn't everything? Imelda was not. She was real, tangible, a work of art that Carl could not lose. Not to Pete Flint, anyway. Rounds 13, 14, and 15 were dragged out beautifully by the auctioneer, each ending in rapturous applause. Word had spread quickly, and everyone knew it was Carl Trudeau and Pete Flint. When the applause died, the two heavyweights settled in for more. Carl nodded at 16 million, then accepted the applause.
"Do we have 17 million?"
boomed the auctioneer, quite excited himself. A long pause. The tension was electric.
"Very well. We have 16. Going once? Going twice? Ah, yes, we have 17 million.
Carl had been making and breaking vows throughout the ordeal, but he was determined not to exceed 17 million bucks. As the roar died down, he settled back in his seat, cool as any corporate raider with billions in play. He was finished and quite happy about it. Flint was bluffing, and now Flint was stuck with the old girl for $17 million.
"Dare I ask for 18?
More applause. More time for Carl to think. If he was willing to pay 17, why not 18? And if he jumped at 18, then Flint would realize that he, Carl, was staying to the bloody end. It was worth a try.
18?
Asked the auctioneer.
Yes, Carl said loud enough for many to hear.
The strategy worked. Pete Flint retreated to the safety of his unspent cash and watched with amusement as the great Carl Trudeau finished off a lousy deal.
Sold for 18 million to Mr. Carl Trudeau,
roared the auctioneer, and the crowd leapt to its feet. They lured Imelda so her new owners could pose with her. Many others, both envious and proud, gawked at the Trudeaus and their new addition. A band cranked up, and it was time to dance. Brianna was in heat. The money had sent her into a frenzy, and halfway through the first dance, Carl gently shoved her back a step. She was hot and lewd, and flashing as much skin as possible. Folks were watching, and that was fine with her.
"Let's get out of here," Carl said after the second dance.
Chapter 4. During the night, Wes had somehow managed to gain the sofa, a much softer resting place, and when he awoke before daylight, Mac was wedged tightly by his side. Mary Grace and Liza were sprawled on the floor beneath them, wrapped in blankets and dead to the world. They had watched television until both kids dropped off, then quietly opened and finished a bottle of cheap champagne they had been saving. The alcohol and the fatigue knocked them out, and they vowed to sleep forever. 5 hours later, Wes opened his eyes and could not close them. He was back in the courtroom, sweating and nervous, watching the jurors file in, praying, searching for a sign, then hearing the majestic words of Judge Harrison, words that would ring in his ears forever. Today would be a fine day, and Wes couldn't waste any more of it on the sofa. He eased away from Mac, covered him with a blanket, and moved silently to their cluttered bedroom, where he slipped into his running shoes and shorts and a sweatshirt. During the trial, he tried to run every day, often at midnight, often at 5 in the morning. A month earlier, he had found himself 6 miles from home at 3 a.m. The running cleared his mind and relieved the stress. He plotted strategy, cross-examined witnesses, argued with Jared Curtin, appealed to the jurors, did a dozen tasks as he pounded the asphalt in the dark. Perhaps on this run he might concentrate on something, anything other than the trial. Maybe a vacation, a beach. But the appeal was already bugging him. Mary Grace did not move as he eased from the apartment and locked the door behind him. It was 5:15. Without stretching, he took off and was soon on Hardy Street, headed for the campus of the University of Southern Mississippi. He liked the safety of the place. He circled around the dorms where he once lived, around the football stadium where he once played, and after half an hour, pulled into Java Works, his favorite coffee shop across the street from the campus. He placed 4 quarters on the counter and took a small cup of the house blend. 4 quarters. He almost laughed as he counted them out. He had to plan his coffee and was always looking for quarters. At the end of the counter was a collection of morning newspapers. The front page headline of the Hattiesburg American screamed, "Crane Chemical nailed for $41 million. There was a large, splendid photo of him and Mary Grace leaving the courthouse, tired but happy, and a smaller photo of Jeanette Baker still crying. Lots of quotes from the lawyers, a few from the jurors, including a windy little speech by Dr. Leona Rocha, who evidently had been a force in the jury room. She was quoted as saying, among other gems, "We were angered by Crane's arrogant and calculated abuse of the land, by their disregard for safety, and then their deceit in trying to conceal it." Wes loved that woman. He devoured the long article while ignoring his coffee. The state's largest paper was the Clarion Ledger out of Jackson, and its headline was somewhat more restrained, though still impressive. "Jury faults Crane Chemical. Huge verdict." More photos, quotes, details of the trial, and after a few minutes, Wes caught himself skimming. The Sun-Herald from Biloxi had the best line so far. "Jury to Crane. Fork it over." Front page news and photos in the big dailies. Not a bad day for the little law firm of Peyton and Peyton. The comeback was underway, and Wes was ready. The office phones would start ringing with potential clients in need of divorces and bankruptcies and 100 other nuisances that Wes had no stomach for. He would politely send them away to other small-timers, of which there was an endless supply, and he would check the nets each morning and look for the big ones. A massive verdict, photos in the paper, the talk of the town, and business was about to increase substantially. He drained his coffee and hit the street. Carl Trudeau also left home before sunrise. He could hide in his penthouse all day and let his communications people deal with the disaster. He could hide behind his lawyers. He could hop on his jet and fly away to his villa on Anguilla or his mansion in Palm Beach. But not Carl. He had never run from a brawl, and he wouldn't start now. Plus, he wanted to get away from his wife. She had cost him a fortune last night, and he was resenting it. "Good morning," he said abruptly to Tolliver as he scampered into the rear seat of the Bentley. "Good morning, sir." Tolliver wasn't about to ask something stupid, such as, "How are you doing, sir?" It was 5:30, not an unusual hour for Mr. Trudeau, but not a customary one either. They normally left the penthouse an hour later. "Let's push it," the boss said, and Tolliver roared down Fifth Avenue. 20 minutes later, Carl was in his private elevator with Stu, an assistant whose only job was to be on call 24/7 in case the great man needed something. Stu had been alerted an hour earlier and given instructions: fix the coffee, toast a wheat bagel, squeeze the orange juice. He was given a list of 6 newspapers to arrange on Mr. Trudeau's desk, and was in the midst of an internet search for stories about the verdict. Carl barely acknowledged his presence. In his office, Stu took his jacket, poured his coffee, and was told to hurry along with the bagel and juice. Carl settled into his aerodynamic designer chair, cracked his knuckles, rolled himself up to his desk, took a deep breath, and picked up the New York Times. Front page, left column. Not front page of the business section, but the front page of the whole damned paper. Right up there with a bad war, a scandal in Congress, dead bodies in Gaza. The front page. "Crane Chemical held liable in toxic deaths," read the headline, and Carl's clenched jaw began to slacken. Byline, Hattiesburg, Mississippi. A state court jury awarded a young widow $3 million in actual damages and $38 million in punitive damages in her wrongful death claims against Crane Chemical. Carl read quickly. He knew the wretched details. The Times got most of them right. Every quote from the lawyers was so predictable. Blah, blah, blah. But why the front page? He took it as a cheap shot and was soon hit with another on page 2 of Business, where an analyst of some variety held forth on Crane's other legal problems, to wit, hundreds of potential lawsuits claiming pretty much the same thing Jeanette Baker had claimed. According to the expert, a name Carl had never seen, which was unusual, Crane's exposure could be several billion in cash. And since Crane, with its questionable policies regarding liability insurance, was practically naked, such exposure could be catastrophic. Carl was cursing when Stu hurried in with juice and a bagel. "Anything else, sir?" he asked. "No. Now close the door." Carl rallied briefly in the arts section. On the front page beneath the fold, there was a story about last night's MUAB event, the highlight of which had been a spirited bidding war and so on. In the bottom right-hand corner was a decent-sized color photo of Mr. and Mrs. Carl Trudeau posing with their newest acquisition. Brianna, ever photogenic, as she damned well should be, emanated glamour. Carl looked rich, thin, and young, he thought, and Imelda was as baffling in print as she was in person. Was she really a work of art? Or was she just a hodgepodge of bronze and cement thrown together by some confused soul working hard to appear tortured? The latter, according to a Times art critic, the same pleasant gentleman Carl had chatted with before dinner. When asked by the reporter if Mr. Trudeau's $18 million purchase was a prudent investment, the critic answered, "No, but it is certainly a boost for the museum's capital campaign." He then went on to explain that the market for abstract sculpture had been stagnant for over a decade and wasn't likely to improve, at least in his opinion. He saw little future for Imelda. The story concluded on page 7 with 2 paragraphs and a photo of the sculptor, Pablo, smiling at the camera and looking very much alive and, well, sane. Nevertheless, Carl was pleased, if only for a moment. The story was positive. He appeared unfazed by the verdict, resilient, in command of his universe. The good press was worth something, though he knew its value was somewhere far south of $18 million. He crunched the bagel without tasting it. Back to the carnage. It was splashed across the front pages of the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, and USA Today. After 4 newspapers, he was tired of reading the same quotes from the lawyers and the same predictions from the experts. He rolled back from his desk, sipped his coffee, and reminded himself of exactly how much he loathed reporters. But he was still alive. The battering by the press was brutal, and it would continue. But he, the great Carl Trudeau, was taking their best shots and still on his feet. This would be the worst day of his professional life, but tomorrow would be better. It was 7 a.m. The market opened at 9:30. Crane's stock closed at $52.50 the day before, up $1.25 because the jury was taking forever and appeared to be hung. The morning's experts were predicting panic selling, but their damage estimates were all over the board. He took a call from his communications director and explained that he would not talk to any reporters, journalists, analysts, whatever they call themselves, and regardless of how many were calling or camped out in the lobby. Just stick to the company line. We are planning a vigorous appeal and expect to prevail. Do not deviate one word. At 7:15, Bobby Ratzlaff arrived with Felix Bard, the chief financial officer. Neither had slept more than 2 hours, and both were amazed that their boss had found the time to go partying. They unpacked their thick files, made the obligatory terse greetings, then huddled around the conference table. They would be there for the next 12 hours. There was much to discuss, but the real reason for the meeting was that Mr. Trudeau wanted some company in his bunker when the market opened and all hell broke loose. Ratzlaff went first. A truckload of post-trial motions would be filed, Nothing would change, and the case would move on to the Mississippi Supreme Court. The court has a history of being plaintiff-friendly, but that's changing. We have reviewed the rulings in big tort cases over the past 2 years, and the court usually splits 5-4 in favor of the plaintiff, but not always.
How long before the final appeal is over? Carl asked.
18 to 24 months. Ratzlaff moved on. 140 lawsuits were on file against Crane because of the Bowmore mess, about a third of them being death cases. According to an exhaustive and ongoing study by Ratzlaff, his staff, and their lawyers in New York, Atlanta, and Mississippi, there were probably another 300 to 400 cases with legitimate potential, meaning that they involved either death, probable death, or moderate to severe illness. There could be thousands of cases in which the claimants suffered minor ailments, such as skin rashes, lesions, and nagging coughs, but for the time being, these were classified as frivolous. Because of the difficulty and cost of proving liability and linking it with an illness, most of the cases on file had not been pushed aggressively. This, of course, was about to change. I'm sure the plaintiff's lawyers down there are quite hungover this morning, Ratzlaff said. But Carl did not crack a smile. He never did. He was always reading, never looking at the person with the floor, and missed nothing.
How many cases do the Paytons have? He asked.
Around 30. We're not sure, because they have not actually filed suit in all of them. There's a lot of waiting here.
One article said that the Baker case almost bankrupted them.
True, they hocked everything.
Bank loans?
Yes, that's the rumor.
Do we know which banks?
I'm not sure if we know that.
Find out. I want the loan numbers, terms, everything.
Got it.
There were no good options, Ratzlaff said, working from his outline. The dam has cracked. The flood is coming. The lawyers will attack with a vengeance, and the defense costs would quadruple to $100 million a year easily. The nearest case could be ready for trial in 8 months. Same courtroom, same judge.
Another big verdict, and, well, who knows?
Carl glanced at his watch and mumbled something about making a call. He left the table again, paced around the office, then stopped at the windows looking south. The Trump Building caught his attention. Its address was 40 Wall Street, very near the New York Stock Exchange, where before long the common shares of Crane Chemical would be the talk of the day as investors jumped ship and speculators gawked at the roadkill. How cruel, how ironic that he, the great Carl Trudeau, a man who had so often watched happily from above as some unfortunate company flamed out, would now be fighting off the vultures. How many times had he engineered the collapse of a stock's price so he could swoop down and buy it for pennies? His legend had been built with such ruthless tactics. How bad would it be? That was the great question, always followed soon by number two. How long would it last? He waited.
Chapter 5.
Tom Huff put on his darkest and finest suit, and after much debate decided to arrive at work at the Second State Bank a few minutes later than usual. An earlier entry would seem too predictable, perhaps a little too cocky, and more important, he wanted everyone in place when he arrived. The old tellers on the main floor, the cute secretaries on the second, and the vice-somethings, his rivals, on the third floor. Huffy wanted a triumphant arrival with as big an audience as possible. He had gambled bravely with the Paytons, and the moment belonged to him. What he got instead was an overall dismissal by the tellers, a collective cold shoulder from the secretaries, and enough devious grins from his rivals to make him suspicious. On his desk, he found a message marked urgent to see Mr. Kirkhead. Something was up, and Huffy began to feel considerably less cocky. So much for a dramatic entrance. What was the problem? Mr. Kirkhead was in his office waiting with the door open, always a bad sign. The boss hated open doors, and in fact boasted of a closed-door management style. He was caustic, rude, cynical, and afraid of his shadow, and closed doors served him well.
"Sit down,"
he barked, with no thought of a good morning or a hello, or heaven forbid a congratulations. He was camped behind his pretentious desk, fat hairless head bent low, as if he sniffed the spreadsheets as he read them.
"And how are you, Mr. Kirkhead?"
Huffy chirped. How badly he wanted to say prickhead, because he said it every other time he referred to his boss. Even the old gals on the main floor sometimes used the substitution.
"Swell. Did you bring the patent file?"
"No, sir. I wasn't asked to bring the patent file. Something the matter?"
"Two things, actually, now that you mention it. First, we have this disastrous loan to these people, over $400,000, past due, of course, and horribly under-collateralized. By far the worst loan in the bank's portfolio."
He said "these people" as if Wes and Mary Grace were credit card thieves.
"This is nothing new, sir."
"Mind if I finish? And now we have this obscene jury award, which as the banker holding the paper, I guess I'm supposed to feel good about. But as a commercial lender and business leader in this community, I think it really sucks. What kind of message do we send to prospective industrial clients with verdicts like this?
Don't dump toxic waste in our state?"
Prickhead's fat jowls turned red as he swept away Huffy's retort with the wave of a hand. He cleared his throat, almost gargling with his own saliva.
"This is bad for our business climate," he said. "Front page all over the world this morning. I'm getting phone calls from the home office. A very bad day."
Lots of bad days over in Beaumont, too, Huffy thought, especially with all those funerals.
$41 million, Prickhead went on, "for a poor woman who lives in a trailer."
"Nothing wrong with trailers, Mr. Kirkhead. Lots of good folks live in them around here. We make the loans."
"You missed the point. It's an obscene amount of money. The whole system has gone crazy. And why here? Why is Mississippi known as a judicial hellhole? Why do trial lawyers love our little state? Just look at some of the surveys. It's bad for business, Huff. For our business."
"Yes, sir. But you must feel better about the patent loan this morning."
"I want it repaid, and soon."
"So do I."
"Give me a schedule. Get with these people and put together a repayment plan, one that I will approve only when it looks sensible. And do it now."
"Yes, sir. But it might take a few months for them to get back on their feet. They've practically shut down."
"I don't care about them, Huff. I just want this damn thing off the books."
"Yes, sir. Is that all?"
"Yes. And no more litigation loans, you understand?"
"Don't worry."
Three doors down from the bank, the Honorable Jared Curtin made a final inspection of the troops before heading back to Atlanta and the icy reception waiting there. Headquarters was a recently renovated old building on Front Street. The well-heeled defense of Crane Chemical had leased it 2 years earlier, then retrofitted it with an impressive collection of technology and personnel. The mood was somber, as might be expected, though many of the locals were not troubled by the verdict. After months of working under Curtin and his arrogant henchmen from Atlanta, they felt a quiet satisfaction in watching them retreat in defeat. And they would be back. The verdict guaranteed new enthusiasm from the victims, more lawsuits, trials, and so on. On hand to witness the farewell was Frank Sully, local counsel and partner in a Hattiesburg defense firm, first hired by Crane and later demoted in favor of a big firm from Atlanta. Sully had been given a seat at the rather crowded defense table and had suffered the indignity of sitting through a 4-month trial without saying a word in open court. Sully had disagreed with virtually every tactic and strategy employed by Curtin. So deep was his dislike and distrust of the Atlanta lawyers that he had circulated a secret memo to his partners in which he predicted a huge punitive award. Now he gloated privately. But he was a professional. He served his client as well as his client would allow, and he never failed to do what Curtin instructed him to do. And he would gladly do it all over again, because Crane Chemical had paid his little firm over $1 million to date. He and Curtin shook hands at the front door, Both knew they would speak by phone before the day was over. Both were quietly thrilled by the departure. Two leased vans hauled Curtin and 10 others to the airport, where a handsome little jet was waiting for the 70-minute flight, though they were in no hurry. They missed their homes and families, but what could be more humiliating than limping back from Podunk with their tails between their legs? Carl remained safely tucked away on the 45th floor, while on the street the rumors raged. At 9:15, his banker from Goldman Sachs called, for the third time that morning, and delivered the bad news that the exchange might not open trading with Crane's common shares. It was too volatile. There was too much pressure to sell.
"Looks like a fire sale," he said bluntly, and Carl wanted to curse him.
The market opened at 9:30 a.m., and Crane's trading was delayed. Carl, Ratzlaff, and Felix Bard were at the conference table, exhausted, sleeves rolled up, elbows deep in papers and debris, phones in each hand, all conversations frantic. The bomb finally landed just after 10 a.m., when Crane began trading at $40 a share. There were no buyers, and none at $35. The plunge was temporarily reversed at $29.50 when speculators entered the fray and began buying. Up and down it went for the next hour. At noon, it was at $27.25 in heavy trading, and to make matters worse, Crane was the big business story of the morning. For their market updates, the cable shows happily switched to their Wall Street analysts, all of whom gushed about the stunning meltdown of Crane Chemical. Then back to the headlines, body count from Iraq, the monthly natural disaster, and Crane Chemical. Bobby Ratzlaff asked permission to run to his office. He took the stairs one flight down and barely made it to the men's room. The stalls were empty. He went to the far one, raised the lid, and vomited violently. His 90,000 shares of Crane Common had just decreased in value from about $4.5 million to around $2.5 million, and the collapse wasn't over. He used the stock as collateral for all his toys, the small house in the Hamptons, the Porsche Carrera, half interest in a sailboat, not to mention overhead items such as private school tuition and golf club memberships. Bobby was now unofficially bankrupt. For the first time in his career, he understood why they jumped from buildings in 1929. The Paytons had planned to drive to Bowmore together, but a last-minute visit to their office by their banker changed things. Wes decided to stay behind and deal with Huffy. Mary Grace took the Taurus and drove to her hometown. She went to Pine Grove, then to the church, where Jeanette Baker was waiting along with Pastor Denny Ott and a crowd of other victims represented by the Payton firm. They met privately in the fellowship hall and lunched on sandwiches, one of which was eaten by Jeanette herself, a rarity. She was composed, rested, happy to be away from the courthouse and all its proceedings. The shock of the verdict was beginning to wear off. The possibility of money changing hands lightened the mood, and it also prompted a flood of questions. Mary Grace was careful to downplay expectations. She detailed the arduous appeals ahead for the Baker verdict. She was not optimistic about a settlement, or a cleanup, or even the next trial. Frankly, she and Wes did not have the funds nor the energy to take on Crane in another long trial, though she did not share this with the group. She was confident and reassuring. Her clients were at the right place. She and Wes had certainly proved that. There would soon be many lawyers sniffing around Bowmore, looking for Crane victims, making promises, offering money perhaps. And not just local lawyers, but the national tort boys, who chased cases from coast to coast and often arrived at the crash sites before the fire trucks. "Trust no one," she said softly but sternly. "Crane will flood the area with investigators, snitches, informants, all looking for things that might be used against you one day in court. Don't talk to reporters, because something said in jest could sound quite different in a trial. Don't sign anything, unless it's first reviewed by the Paytons. Don't talk to other lawyers. She gave them hope. The verdict was echoing through the judicial system. Government regulators had to take note. The chemical industry could no longer ignore them. Crane's stock was crashing at that very moment, and when the stockholders lost enough money, they would demand changes. When she finished, Denny Ott led them in prayer. Mary Grace hugged her clients, wished them well, promised to see them again in a few days, then walked with Ott to the front of the church for her next appointment. The journalist's name was Tip Shepherd. He had arrived about a month earlier, and after many attempts had gained the confidence of Pastor Ott, who then introduced him to Wes and Mary Grace. Shepherd was a freelancer with impressive credentials, several books to his credit, and a Texas twang that neutralized some of Bowmore's distrust of the media. The Paytons had refused to talk to him during the trial for many reasons. Now that it was over, Mary Grace would do the first interview. If it went well, there might be another.
"Mr. Kirkhead wants his money," Huffy was saying.
He was in Wes's office, a makeshift room with unpainted sheetrock walls, stained concrete floor, and army surplus furniture. "I'm sure he does," Wes shot back. He was already irritated that his banker would arrive just hours after the verdict with signs of attitude. "Tell him to get in line."
"We're way past due here, Wes. Come on."
"Is Kirkhead stupid? Does he think that the jury gives an award one day and the defendant writes a check the next?"
"Yes, he's stupid, but not that stupid."
"He sent you over here?"
"Yes. He jumped me first thing this morning, and I expect to get jumped for many days to come."
"Couldn't you wait a day, 2 days, maybe a week, let us breathe a little, maybe enjoy the moment?"
"He wants a plan, something in writing, repayments, stuff like that."
"I'll give him a plan," Wes said, his words trailing off. He did not want to fight with Huffy. Though not exactly friends, they were certainly friendly and enjoyed each other's company. Wes was extremely grateful for Huffy's willingness to roll the dice. Huffy admired the Paytons for losing it all as they risked it all. He had spent hours with them as they surrendered their home, office, cars, retirement accounts.
"Let's talk about the next 3 months," Huffy said.
The four legs of his folding chair were uneven, and he rocked slightly as he talked. Wes took a deep breath, gave a roll of the eyes. He suddenly felt very tired. "Once upon a time, we were grossing $50,000 a month, clearing $30,000 before tax.